Millions of people are living better. They are enjoying a healthier lifestyle, learning more about overcoming obstacles and keeping a positive outlook. Now you can be a member of the club. This is the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. Our guests share incredible stories and advice, bring new outlooks on wellness, and show you how to keep moving forward. Now, here is your host, Dr. Joe Casciani.
Welcome, everyone, to today's show. This is the Living to 100 Club Radio Hour on the Voice America Network Health and Wellness Channel. Thanks very much for joining us today. I'm Joe Casciani, your host. Our guest today is an internationally known and respected advocate for right to die laws, Dr. Faye Gersh. As many of you know, the Living to 100 Club is all about facing the future with an adventurous spirit and staying positive in the face of adversity. But sometimes this adversity is too strong and wins out over just keeping a positive outlook. So we face the prospect of losing the battle to stay alive. Our guests will help to understand how deaths can be good deaths and how to avoid the loss of dignity and control that are so important to each of us. We're very open to your questions and comments. You can either call them in during the show to this number, 866-472-5792, or you can send your questions by email to info@living200club.club. And now, let me introduce our guest. Faye Gersh was president of the Hemlock Society, USA, from 1996 to 2004, following its founder, Derek Humphrey. Concurrent with this national position, she began the Hemlock Society of San Diego in 1987 and was its president for 22 years. Faye was also president of the World Federation of Right to Die Societies and currently serves as a board member. She initiated the Caring Friends program, which eventually became the Final Exit Network. In 2003, Faye was awarded Hemlock's Lifetime Achievement Award. Dr. Gersh received her doctorate in human development from Harvard University. She was an associate professor and chair of the psychology department at Morehouse College for 9 years, was a research associate at the University of Chicago, and taught at Roosevelt and Northwestern universities. For 18 years, she practiced as a clinical and forensic psychologist in San Diego. She's lectured extensively in the U.S. and abroad, and has appeared extensively on radio and TV, and now on the Living to 100 Club. Now I'd like to introduce Faye Gersh. Welcome, Faye.
Thanks for that introduction, Joe. Appreciate it.
Yes.
You can tell I'm pretty old, having done all that in my lifetime.
Yeah, a few accomplishments along the way.
I started all this when I was young, and the right to die was sort of an academic but very interesting topic. But now that I'm old, it's very personal.
Yes. Yes. Well, tell us about how you got involved. How did you get started, and why did you get started in the right to die movement?
Well, I, like many people, never gave it a thought, actually, until being a board member of the ACLU of Southern California, we had a request from a 28-year-old quadriplegic woman who wanted to die by refusing food and fluids. That was in 1983, and she couldn't do it legally. The hospital had to force-feed her, and she was in a lot of pain, and she didn't feel her life was worth living, which some quadriplegics do and some quadriplegics don't. They go on. But she didn't, and she asked the ACLU to take the case to court so she could not eat or drink. And I was a forensic psychologist, and so I was asked by the legal team to examine her to see if she had all her marbles, that she wasn't being coerced, that she was not depressed, that she was giving this rational thought. So I did, and she was quite rational, quite determined, and a very bright and articulate woman. So that's how I got involved. We lost the case in court, although she won her plea 3 years later and on a national level. In 1990, the right to refuse treatment included the right to refuse food and fluids. The Supreme Court agreed. So that's how I got involved. And then in 1986, I had a big conference here in San Diego, and I invited a lot of leaders of the right to die movement including Derek Humphrey, who was the founder of the Hemlock Society. And what he said made such a difference in the way I thought about death. I just never gave it a thought. And he said, death should be a gentle, peaceful procedure surrounded by people that you love. You shouldn't have to resort to desperate measures like dying in your car alone or jumping off buildings or jumping in front of trains or taking poisons. You should have a legal medical way to die. And that made a big dent in my thinking, and we started the Hemlock Society of San Diego in 1987, and we're still going 32 years later.
Yeah, so that's so interesting that one case can kind of be the precipitant for so much of this, and we know it happens all over around the country and actually around the world, I'm sure. So
definitely,
how would you how would you define a peaceful death? How do you define that? I mean, death is obviously well, we know what it is. So how would you define
You know, I don't think it's the same for everybody. Like when you gave your introduction, you said something about eventually you succumb to death or eventually it takes you and you can't fight anything. So the implication was that death was some kind of failure in life, and if you fought hard enough, it wouldn't happen. Well, I don't think that's the case. I think death is a natural part of life. It can be a good part of life. And it can be something that you can plan for and talk to your loved ones about and know it's going to happen and just try to arrange the best death. So you asked me what I would think a peaceful death is, and I think I would change that to a good death. Peaceful, you can die a lot of ways peacefully, but a good death, I think, is you die the way you would want to die with your family around you, if you wish, and your friends. And I think quickly, but not that's not always the criterion. You should die, I think, painlessly. But again, for many people, as long as they die the way they want to, they may suffer a lot. Some religions feel that suffering is ennobling, and that's their choice. The main thing to me is that you should die the way you choose to die. And we don't quite have that privilege in the United States yet. Many of us would choose to die with a medication from our doctor, maybe injected, so we don't have to be able to swallow, but we don't have that available in the United States to us.
Right, right. Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit more. But, you know, I said that, you know, about living to 100 club, and I still maintain, obviously, we're not all going to live to 100, and there's always going to be adverse events. And my notion is, well, while we're still going, while we're still kicking, are we doing what we can to stay positive no matter what our condition is? And I, you know, I can appreciate what you're saying, that there is the inevitability
of dying. And I can appreciate what you're
saying.
No, I totally sure. agree with you.
Yeah. So,
but not to think that death is a defeat, and not to think it's a surprise when it happens, and not to prepare for it.
Yeah, so to be prepared for it, and to set the conditions, set the circumstances up so that it is a good death, as you say.
Yeah. And that's,
so what
that, that involves talking
go
about
ahead.
It.
Sorry.
You know, it's very easy to talk about exercise and good diets and what our doctors do for us, but also to talk about what kind of death we want. And what do we want before death and after death? What kind of ceremonies do we want? And just to know that death is in our futures, like it is in all living things, and that we do have some control over it.
Right. But, as you know, it's very hard to talk about for many people. A friend of mine once said it's like looking at the sun, and it's so unpleasant that we avoid it.
Well, I don't know. You know, I've been in the Hemlock Society now 32, whatever years, and we have national conferences and international conferences, and we all talk about dying, and it's pretty cheerful. And we don't find it we don't find it morbid, but of course we comprise, I guess, a small percentage of the population. But that's our goal in life, is to help people understand how to prepare for death and how to accept that it's going to happen.
Yeah, I can see that. That's an important goal, to help people just be more comfortable with this level of conversation and not avoid it, because obviously it is such a reality. What have you learned
about...
Our
only reality.
What's that?
I said it's our only reality. I mean, some of us don't even have to pay taxes, but death is inevitable.
Right. So, what have you learned about other societies compared to the U.S.? You've traveled around. I know you've given many presentations internationally. What have you learned about different societies' comfort level with this subject?
You know, our closest neighbor, Canada, has really beaten us to the punch. It has a much better, I think, better law that permit the whole country, everybody in the country is permitted to have medical aid in dying. And that, our law means, our law permits us to get a prescription from a doctor, and we talk about that later, and then be able to swallow it when the time comes, essentially on our own. But in Canada, you can get a lethal injection in a hospital given by your doctor or a nurse practitioner, and you can die that way, and that means you can live a lot longer because you don't have to be able to swallow. And it's a universal law all over the country. Ours is only in, so far, and it's been a struggle, the 9 states and District of Columbia. And the law is more liberal in that in our country you have to be terminally ill. That is, two doctors have to say you have 6 months or less to live. In Canada, it's a little more broader than that, and they're trying to expand it even further. So Canada is a very good place to look to see how it could be done, or should be done, I think. Holland, of course, has been a pioneer in this for a long time. Belgium, the Benelux countries in general, and Colombia in South America has taken a lead in permitting aid in dying. And then around the world, I would say, and I think throughout history, doctors have been acquainted with the families and acquainted with the patients and made house visits, and they knew when it was time to end the suffering of a dying patient. And they would do it quietly. Sometimes the family knew, sometimes they didn't. But that doesn't happen anymore. It may happen in small towns, but because there's so many advances in medicine and because it's such a litigious profession these days and doctors can get sued so easily, that doctors are reluctant to do it. They may do it for a particular patient quietly, but generally it's very hard to ask your doctor for help when there's no law. And even when there is a law, like there is in California and 8 other states, it's hard to get a doctor to agree to do it. So I think we are somewhere in the middle there. You know, we have some laws in place, and we're progressive in some ways, but compared to other countries, we're pretty far behind.
Well, I'd like to pick up on this. It's time for a short break, if we could hold that thought, Faye. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Dr. Faye Gersh. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We have much more to talk about.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living to 100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living to 100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Are you living a healthy and fit lifestyle? It's not just related to your physical well-being. It also means a healthier mind, confidence, improved health, stamina, and fitness. Talking with Tremaine brings it all to you. Host Tremaine Ellis, along with her husband and co-host David Ellis, will offer support, advice, guidance, and motivation to keep you in your best shape, both physically and mentally. Talking with Tremaine can be heard live every Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and 3 Pacific on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel.
Have you become a member yet? Sign up now to become a member of Voice America. It's always free and easy. Plus, you get to take advantage of some great member benefits. Get unlimited access to millions of hours of on-demand content across all of our channels. Keep track of your favorite episodes, shows, and hosts in your own customizable library. Find out what shows you might be interested in based on your favorites. Plus, you get insider access with our newsletter. Membership gives you more. Sign up at voiceamerica.com and click register at the top right.
Real Life Solutions, Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, thanks to everyone for staying with us. We're back. We're having a discussion with Dr. Faye Gersh. Faye, just before the break, we were just touching on a lot of the other countries that you're aware of where they have similar laws or are progressive in their thinking. And I'm curious, you know, it's probably a big question, but what do these other countries have in this mindset that we don't have here in the U.S.? What's, I mean, Canada, just for example. Canada has the whole country, and we have, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, the first country to really get started on this idea was Holland. And you know, they have done a lot of very courageous things during World War II. They were very defiant against the Nazis, and they were one of the first countries to permit abortion. And they're a very courageous and open country. They talk about things that are social issues, and then they try to act on them. And I think in our country, maybe we don't talk about a lot of things that are on people's minds, and it takes us a long time to act on them. So I don't know. I know we have a big pro-life contingent in this country, but I feel I'm pro-life. I would defend life to its ultimate, but I would also defend the right of a person to end their life if their suffering becomes unbearable for them. So, sure. And a lot of it is driven by religion. And for some religions, it's a big issue. I have to say that in the Hemlock Society, I've worked with a lot of people who are very religious and who believe that their God is a merciful God who would not let them suffer, who gives them intelligence and the right and the ability to make choices about their life. So I don't think, although the opposition comes primarily from the Catholic Church and now a little bit from the Mormon Church, that the bulk of congregants agree with that position. We know from statistical surveys that the majority of Catholics do a lot of things that the Catholic Church doesn't agree with, and the majority of Catholics do believe that people who are suffering at the end of life should have the ability to get help from a doctor to die peacefully.
The majority,
I think, that is
Catholics,
one contingent that is stronger in this country maybe than other countries.
Hmm. Right. Yeah, so it's not a religious, not necessarily a religious restriction or belief that says this is not allowed in my religion.
Well,
there are the exceptions.
The religions say it is. The religions say it's a belief that they adhere to, but there's not evidence in the Bible. There's not any written evidence until St. Augustine came along that anybody would have problems with people who want to end their lives for heroic reasons or for merciful reasons or for suffering reasons. So that is not something that you see in the Bible. There are several, I think there's seven, allusions to suicide in the Bible. But none of them with condemnation. Just, it happened.
Mm-hmm.
It happened for some good reason.
Reference to.
But not that the person's going to live in hell forever or anything. Any form of condemnation about these episodes.
Mm. Well, that's, you know, certainly a worthwhile discussion to pursue. I'd like to, if we could, just jump into some of the more technical or just different features of this. Just for example, let's talk about the advance directive. So what do we need to know about advance directives? What would you want our listeners to understand about advance directives?
They're very important. There's two parts. One part is if you can figure out in advance what you would want to happen to you and what you wouldn't want. For example, if you're old and frail and not in good health, you would probably not want to be resuscitated if your heart stops. And you can say that. Or if you are, if you have a very severe stroke or have a very severe other kind of illness, cancer or heart disease, maybe you would not want to be tube-fed if you couldn't feed yourself. Or maybe if you were hit by a truck, you might want to be tube-fed until somebody, a reliable doctor, said that you have no chance to live a reasonable life or that you're going to recover in a month or two, and during that time you could be tube-fed. So those are kind of things. Breathing machines, same principle. So resuscitation, artificial feeding, artificial breathing, those kind of things, you can say in advance what you would want. But generally, it's very hard to specify everything that was that could come along. And so the second part of the advance directive is choosing the person to speak for you when you can no longer speak for yourself. In fact, the advance directive doesn't go into effect unless you can't speak for yourself. So this person that you designate, your healthcare agent or proxy or surrogate, whoever you want to call this person, you say, I want this person, in my case it's my son, to make these decisions for me if I can. And I trust him, even though he's going to inherit all my money, I trust him to know what I would want, not necessarily what he would want, although he does think like I do, but what I would want. And the only way he would know that is for me to talk to him and tell him what I would want and what I don't want. So that's the important part of an advance directive, is communication with the people that are going to care about you when it's time, and your doctor, and then writing it down so that everybody's protected, the hospital's protected, your kids are protected, and you are protected, because people know what you want and what you don't want. And that comes in various forms. There's a regular advance directive. You can make out your own. There's several online, and they're all valid. And then there's, in some states, what we have in California is called the POLST, which stands for Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And that's an official document. It has to be signed by your doctor, and it's supposed to follow you around so that if you can no longer speak for yourself, that document is in your file, and it says, again, what you want about resuscitation, artificial feeding, artificial breathing, and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And another document that some people have is a Do Not Resuscitate Order, which means only that if your heart stops, you do or do not want cardiopulmonary resuscitation. It has nothing to do with any other kind of treatment. It's just cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So DNR means do not resuscitate. And it's a special document, again, signed by your doctor, that you can submit. And in California, you submit it to a special place, and you can get jewelry, necklace or a bracelet, that says do not resuscitate. And the EMTs, the emergency medical technicians who might be called, should not always do they, but should respect that document and make you comfortable, but not start your heart again. So the main thing is communication with the people that you care about, what it is you want.
Yeah, so to document your wishes, to document your desires, should any of these events take place. Now, does the pulse replace the surrogate? Do you still need the surrogate to make, you know, to act in your place if you have the pulse agreement?
The pulse technically doesn't require a surrogate. So that means if you didn't fill out an advance directive and you can't speak for yourself and you're in the hospital very ill, a trusted person can fill out the pulse on your behalf. Really, it should not replace the advance directive. No, the advance directive should be a document thought out way before and discussed with your family members. The pulse should too, but the pulse, initially anyway, was designed for older people, people over 80 and or people with severe chronic diseases or terminal illnesses. So they're a little bit different, and they're complementary, and really one shouldn't replace the other, but on occasion, when there's no advance directive, the pulse can be used.
I see. So in your experience, is this, these documents, are they generally accepted internationally? I take it they're accepted throughout the U.S.? I mean, are there exceptions in the U.S.? Some states?
I wish. It's not quite that simple. Each state has its own regulations about that. Some states don't even permit a do not resuscitate order. Most do, although there are different circumstances. The advance directive should be considered by each state, but if you happen to live in two states, like 6 months in Florida and 6 months in Alaska or something, you should have a document that's legal in both states. Legal in both states. So there may be two documents. But if you just happen to be traveling to Alaska on a cruise ship and something happens and you have your advance directive with you, I'm sure they would respect it. So it depends how much time you spend in each state. As far as internationally goes, that's another question. There are a lot of countries in this world. I do a lot of traveling and I really don't know when I travel to, say, Ethiopia or Russia, or these are two countries I've been in the past year, what they would do if they saw my advance directive. I don't know. Hopefully they would honor it, and hopefully they would find it.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
Do you travel with them?
Probably not.
Bring these
I
documents?
Did take my advance. Yes, I definitely took it to Russia a couple of months ago, and it was in my luggage. And since I don't live in my luggage, if my heart stopped beating, I was on the cruise or whatever, at the a museum or something, then I don't know what would have happened.
Sure.
I guess the default position in the United States is if you don't have anything that says not to treat, they will treat. So even if you intended to not live on a breathing machine for the rest of your life, if it's not documented and your healthcare surrogate is not there to say so, you will be on a ventilator for the rest of your life. And we have people like that. We have some 4,000 people just in San Diego alone, where I live, who are on ventilators, who are essentially in persistent vegetative states, who have no consciousness, but they have no documents that say, I don't want to be this way. And so they're maintained in state facilities on ventilators and breathing machines, and feeding machines, until they die a natural death. So if you don't have documents and you don't have a surrogate and something happens to you, you are at risk for getting treatment that you may not want.
Right.
Or
for being kept alive. Being kept alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a case that was written up just recently in San Diego. I think the person was in a skilled nursing facility for 10 or 15
years. Yes.
You probably saw that, yeah. So that's the type of case you're discussing.
And I wrote a letter to the editor saying, if you don't want this to happen to you, make sure you have an advance directive. I mean, that's not funny, but this man didn't. And I think there were legal things that could have been done so that he didn't have to be in this. I mean, it was a life, I suppose, but he couldn't walk, he couldn't talk, he couldn't feed himself, he couldn't control his bowels or bladder, he couldn't do anything for 17 years. But they did locate his sister, and his sister could have filled out the pulse, you know, like you had asked the question before. Yes, she could have.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, of these 4,000 people that are in these vent farms, they call them, because they're on a ventilator, some of them do have living relatives that could take them out of their misery. I assume it's misery. But choose not to for one reason or another, because I guess they haven't been designated to speak for the patient, so they don't want to.
So where can people go to get this information in their states? Is it the Department of Health, or how would Consumer Affairs? How would somebody in Kansas or Massachusetts find out what the state laws are? Do you know? Can you recommend?
Well, of course, I know California best, and there's the old computer. So in California, and I think in all those other states you mentioned, you can Google Advanced Directive Kentucky or whatever.
Okay.
And one or more forms of the Advanced Directive that's accepted in Kentucky will come up. And the Advanced Directive generally is a very permissive document, so there are many forms of it. And you can even make up your own form. It has to be, in California, it has to be either notarized or signed by two witnesses, but states vary about that requirement. As far as the post is concerned, it's called other things in other states, and not every state has one. But in California, you can Google POLST, P-O-L-S-T, and download a copy. And in fact, when you download the Advanced Directive, you should make a bunch of copies, because all copies are valid, as long as your signature is on it. And then distribute them to people who would have to know what your wishes are, and especially the person you designate as your surrogate. So the POLST is a little different because you have to have a doctor's signature, but in California, you can download a POLST. The copy is valid, and they prefer that you do it on bright pink paper, which you can do, and then have your doctor sign it and have that put in your medical record and carry a copy with you. Carry copies of all these things with you. And the same thing is true. You can Google Do Not Resuscitate California. It's a very helpful page about what it means to resuscitate and when it's used and when it's not appropriate. And you can download that, get your doctor to sign it, and that becomes a valid doctor's orders. So I think probably in most states, old Dr. Google can save the day by printing up these documents for you. And all you have to do is print them out, copy them, fill them out, and make sure the people who are involved get them, get a copy.
That's very useful, practical advice. Thanks for that. Looks like it's time to take a short break. When we come back, I'd like to spend the remaining time on the whole notion of medically assisted deaths, because that's really the kind of turning point for so many of these states. So it's time to take a short break. This is Joe Casciani, and my guest is Dr. Faye Gersh. You're listening to the Living to 100 Club on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Stay tuned. We have much more to talk about.
opinions, options, answers. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
Visit the Living to 100 Club online store. We feature products and wellness information that help maintain healthy lifestyles, promote mental and physical fitness, and allow you to take control of your future. You'll find a wide array of affordable items for staying active, monitoring your health, and adapting to physical changes. Most popular are items for travel, even with your pets, exercise equipment and clothing, heart rate monitors, and personal care items, and our unique Yes, I'm Positive collection. The Living to 100 Club Store offers convenient solutions for active lifestyles. Be sure to spend time on our Learn page for the club's inspiring blog series and add your name to our email list. The Living to 100 Club online store for awareness, convenience, and independence. Find us at livingto100.club. That's livingto100.club.
Sometimes it just seems that nobody understands. There's one individual who can help. If you're living with somebody who faces challenges such as autism, Asperger's, or other exceptional needs, you'll want to tune into Solutions and Strategies with Dr. Sean, Living the Challenge. Together, we'll uncover a variety of solutions to the challenges faced by individuals, their families, and teachers. Listen live every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, on Voice America Health and Wellness.
Have you had a chance to check out Voice America's online magazine and blog? If you love our hosts and shows, check out articles that give an even deeper perspective, plus topics about health and fitness, movie reviews, philosophy, business tips and tactics, spirituality, positive thought, current events, and even more about your favorite hosts. It's just a click away at blog.voiceamerica.com. That's blog.voiceamerica.com. The Voice America Press Blog. All access, all the time.
Your life, your health, your network. You're listening to Voice America Health and Wellness.
You are listening to the Living to 100 Club with Dr. Joe Casciani. To reach the program today, please call in to 1-866-472-5792. That's 1-866-472-5792. You may also send an email to info@livingto100.club. Now, back to this week's show.
Okay, and we're back. This is Joe Casciani, and I have as our guest today Dr. Faye Gersh. Thanks to our listeners for joining us today. Faye, we have some time left, and I'd like to just start to wrestle with this whole notion of medically assisted deaths. We have some laws in California, and as you said, I think 9 states. So let's talk about this a little bit. First, describe the medically assisted death concept. What is that?
Well, the concept is that the end of life can be horrible for some people, not everybody, but death is sometimes your organs fail, you're in a lot of pain, you can't walk, you can't talk, you are miserable, and you want to put an end to the suffering. Or, in some cases, you anticipate a horrible death and you want to end it while you still can. So, as a result of that, the pressure to have laws permitting medical aid in dying have spread to all over the world. And in the United States, the law is based on the Oregon model, which passed 20 years ago, was the first state. And that is the same for every state now except Montana. And that requires that you be a resident of that state, which is not too difficult, and you have two doctors examine you and agree that you have 6 months or less to live, and that you are mentally competent. You have to be, in California, have to be examined alone, no relatives there to presumably coerce you or put words in your mouth. And then there's a 15-day waiting period in California where you have to make the request twice orally and once in writing, witnessed. And at the end of that period, if you are still competent, which can be a question, or you're still able to swallow, your doctor can prescribe medication which will end your life peacefully. Then, when and if you're ready to take it, in California, you have to fill out a document that says, I'm about to do this within 48 hours. And you don't have to mix it yourself. Somebody can help you with that. But you have to be able to take spoon to mouth and swallow it. And then you will die peacefully, painlessly, and fairly quickly sometimes, because the drugs available have varied over the three-year period that we've had this law in California. Some of the drugs now take a little longer than the original drugs, but eventually you're in a coma right away. So whatever you're feeling, you're not aware of it. And you die, and the death certificate says you died from cancer or whatever the underlying disease is, and the law states specifically that this is not assisted suicide. It is not suicide for insurance purposes, for the death certificate purposes, or, as many people are concerned about, for their family's purposes, for the obituary purposes. Suicide still is stigmatized in many places, and so this is not suicide under the law. And that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other states and in other countries...
But it is. Can we say that it is assisted suicide? I mean, it's just a label, I know, and it's a pejorative label, but it is assisted suicide. Is that right?
The law says it is not assisted suicide.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
A variety
it's
of
a semantic
reasons,
question.
I can understand. Yeah. Semantic question. Yeah. And when we talked last time about this, you were saying that there are physicians that are willing to participate and there are physicians who are unwilling to participate, and sometimes it can be a challenge for the individual to find two physicians. Yeah.
Yes. And the same thing is true for hospice. I mean, we're very strong supporters of hospice care and palliative care, but some hospices feel that they will not participate in assisted suicide or call it in California, the End of Life Option Act. And some do, and some will recommend a doctor. Sometimes their medical director will prescribe the medication. And many won't, and we have a lot of hospices around. So it's a good idea if you are considering hospice care, which is a very good idea, to find out how they feel about this, because you may have to do it subversively, find your doctor on your own, or they may be able to help you, and they may have a hospice nurse there when you ingest the medication, which would be really ideal. In Belgium, for example, the hospices and the voluntary euthanasia laws sort of blend in with each other. So if you're getting hospice care and your pain or your suffering is intractable, it's perfectly okay for the hospice people to help you use the law. And in Canada, it's getting to be that way, too. It's more so in Quebec than other provinces, but most of the places, the hospices will be cooperative with their law. So,
right.
And the law is spreading. The first time, the first doctor who ever helped a patient die under the law actually occurred in the Northern Territory of Australia. And that was in 1996. But then after the doctor helped four patients die under the law, it was revoked by the federal parliament. And because it was a territory, not a state, it has not been renewed. But finally, the state of Victoria passed an assisted dying law. And that's just gone into effect. The first patient just used that. And everywhere in Australia, they're trying to pass such a law. Other states, New York is trying to pass a law. North Carolina just didn't pass a law. Maine just did pass a law. Massachusetts is struggling to pass a law. In the Netherlands, Holland, Belgium, and Luxembourg have a law permitting voluntary euthanasia. Switzerland has a law, and they've had a law permitting physician aid in dying. The difference, let me just say the difference, physician aid in dying is that the doctor prescribes something for you to take, you take it. In voluntary euthanasia, the doctor can do that, but also can give you a lethal injection. So you don't have to be able to swallow by the time you do it.
Oh, okay.
And so Switzerland has a physician aid in dying law that they've had for some 30 years now, and they permit foreigners to take advantage of the law. So there are at least two reliable organizations in Switzerland that will help foreigners, and they are Dignitas and Life Circle. And in America, there's another national organization called Final Exit Network that will teach you how to do this yourself. They cannot do it for you, and they don't necessarily use medical means. They use other means, because you can die not just by ingesting drugs, but there's other ways. They teach you that, and if you're eligible. You don't have to be terminally ill for Final Exit Network. And all these places have their own websites, Final Exit Network, the World Federation of Right to Die Societies, Dignitas in Switzerland, Life Circle in Switzerland, Compassion and Choices is the national organization in the United States, Right to Die Canada, Death with Dignity Canada, Death with Dignity National right. Center in the United States, and my organization is the Hemlock Society of San Diego. And we all have websites, and they're all full of information. So people who have computers should not be at a loss for what to do and where to get information.
Let me jump back quickly to the final exit. That notion, I think, does that kind of spring from the Kevorkian days when people were given some?
No.
Let me understand.
Kevorkian actually did physician aid in dying. No, and he also did some voluntary. The last patient he helped to die that was watched by 60 million people on 60 Minutes was Tom Yauch, who had very terminal ALS. He had, according to the coroner, 2 days left to live. And he called Kevorkian, who was close to him in Michigan, and he came over and gave him a lethal injection because I have to call him Tom because I was at the trial and I got to know his relatives and everything. But Tom could no longer swallow, couldn't do anything to help himself die, and so Kevorkian gave him a lethal injection. And as you may remember, that Kevorkian was interviewed by Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes, and there was a picture of Tom Yauch dying. And I think it was very important that everybody saw that, because we don't really see how people die. We don't see how they die in hospice or in hospitals or at home. But Tom Yauch got an injection that just keeled over and died, and that was very peaceful, very quick. And I don't think there was anything ghoulish about that. We should know more about how people die and how to avoid band deaths. So all around the world, this is a consideration. Japan has been thinking about it. China's been thinking about it. Certainly Australia, New Zealand has been thinking about it. And because we all die and there has to be some way to make it better than it usually is, a lot of countries have been paying a lot of attention to this. There are old films about old people dying in China and Japan, and they have their traditions about how they do that. But it's a universal problem and becoming a more of a problem because we have become an aging society. Japan is now an aged society. And we have such a large population of people who are old, sick, and don't really know much and won't think much about how their lives will end. You know, it's very fine to think you want to live to be 100 if that's a good life. But sometimes it's not a good life. And sometimes people, especially you hear them in nursing homes saying, let me die, please God, let me die. And they have no way to get out of this. And so sometimes these are peremptory kinds of things that people have to do beforehand, before their disease gets too bad, like dementia. Find out how to end their lives so that they won't be put in places where they don't want to live in a state that they don't want to be in.
Well, I have so many more questions, but unfortunately it looks like we're out of time for today. I really have so many questions about the voluntary euthanasia and the notion of depression, and there's always the argument that people who are depressed are making these wrong decisions, and we know that it's not a matter of depression. It's still their right to choose. So maybe we can have a follow-up to this episode.
That would be lovely, Joe. I know you and I are both psychologists, and we know about depression, and it's important to sort that out.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks very much, Faye, for being our guest and for sharing these interests and your experiences and your passion for this work. It says
a
lot.
Thank you very much for exposing your audience to these very important questions.
Good.
I know
good.
They want to live to be 100, but they have to give this really some good thought.
Of course. Yeah, that's the important part of it. So thanks to all of our listeners for tuning in today. When you have a minute, please visit our website, living2100.club, and sign up for our email list. And while you're there, please download this member's handbook, 9 Principles for Maintaining a Positive Frame of Mind. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Casciani, and you've been listening to the Living 2100 Club on the Voice America Network. Be sure to join us for next week's show, when our guest will be Elaine Sanchez. Elaine is the founder of CaregiverHelp.com, and we'll be talking all about the stresses that caregivers go through and ways to manage the stress. So that'll be next Friday. And my closing thought for today comes from Albert Einstein. I just like these quotes about quick fixes. You've heard me use some of them in the past, so here's another one. Einstein once said, "If I had 1 hour to solve a problem, I would spend 55 minutes thinking about the problem and 5 minutes thinking about the solutions." So that's our show for today. Thanks again to everyone, and we look forward to having you back on coming weeks.
Thank you for being part of the Living to 100 Club. We hope you'll join Dr. Joe Casciani again next Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, 2 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Health and Wellness Channel. Until next week, stay on the right track to mental and physical fitness.